if we've gone through this much since the election, consider what's lying ahead.
So, Ian McKay, you're a historian who's been teaching Canadian history at Queen's University for over 20 years, and I've had you on Labour Radio, and now there's a book of yours coming out soon, I think early in 2012, Warrior Nation, Rebranding Canada in a Fearful Age.
Right.
Do you talk about 1812 in that book?
We're going to just mention it. It's not going to be the central focus, but it certainly fits into the overall thesis of the book that we're bringing out. And I should mention that I'm co-authoring this with Jamie Swift, Between the Lines Press.
What the central thesis is that Harper is rewriting Canada's history, basically.
Yes, we think that there's a very consistent, integrated campaign to change the very meaning of Canada, to change the meaning of its symbols, to rewrite its history, to transform the meaning of Canadian citizenship, all in ways that conform to an extreme right-wing agenda in which war and repression and the throttling of democratic freedoms will become ever more present themes in all of our lives.
There are plenty of examples right now of money being spent to glorify warfare.
Well, we're particularly struck by a couple of examples. One in particular was the recent Citizenship Guide, which exalts war on almost every page. The old Citizenship Guide used to have a few soldiers and I think one portrait of Her Majesty. The new Citizenship Guide is basically all about redefining Canada as a monarchy and as a war-making monarchy. What we really were impressed with in the Citizenship Guide is the extent to which they're recruiting all the old heroes of the British Empire as heroes the Canadians themselves should admire. So in the Citizenship Guide, you're called upon to admire people who, for example, crushed the Indian drive for independence in 1857. That is 10 years before Canada was even a country. But we're being asked to celebrate imperial heroes who were engaged in things that most Canadians today would say, maybe this wasn't such a great idea. Nonetheless, this is the tenor of the new regime, is to exalt the British Empire at every opportunity. So we're really taken with the Citizenship Guide, which tries to redefine the whole nature of the country. And remember, this is a guide that goes out to perhaps 300,000 people every year who want to be citizens and gives them the authoritative version of Canadian history that they have to actually pass an exam on. So it's not just like, you know, one historian or another historian putting forward their viewpoint. This is the viewpoint of the people of Canada being expressed to people who want to become Canadians. It's a profoundly shocking document.
Apparently, they also say in it that there's an excellent career choice to be had in the Army.
That's right. They give you even the web pages of the Army so that if you want to join, you can go right to that web page. And it's a splendid way to show your indebtedness to the country. Another really striking thing about the Citizenship Guide is the play that they give to John Buchan, who is the Governor General under the name of Lord Tweedsmuir in Canada from 1935 to 1940.
Wrote a couple of novels.
Right, a lot of thrillers, a lot of adventure stories and thrillers, and you know, he wrote over 100 books in the course of his life. A consistent theme of John Buchan is the superiority of the white races, who are called upon to bear the white man's burden and elevate inferior races around the planet, especially in Africa, where John Buchan was instrumental in administering concentration camps. I wonder if John Buchan, who is the only 20th century Canadian political figure to be given his own quotation in the Citizenship Guide, really the only one that gets any sustained attention at all. If John Buchan is really a good model for people who want to learn about Canada, do we really identify Canada with the white man's burden, with Rudyard Kipling, with concentration camps in South Africa? I mean, you'd be interested at McGill that John Buchan actually came to McGill in 1935 and lectured the students at McGill about the grave dangers that they might encounter in their cultural lives. And what these grave dangers were influences that might come from Slavic people or those he called Negroid cultural influences. And he wanted to warn the people of the good students of McGill against being swayed by Negroid cultural influences. This is the person who's brought forward in the Citizenship Guide as our key intellectual of Canadian multiculturalism. Profoundly shocking.
He reminds me a little bit of Karl May and the same type of writer in Germany, a great favorite of Adolf Hitler.
Right. Well, I don't know whether the parallel is exact because I haven't read Karl May, but I have read a lot of John Buchan. He's a very entertaining writer in his time and his place. He wasn't that atypical of people and his racial views. But you see, that's not really the point. The point is not whether we appreciate him as an historical figure and can say, you know, he was a man of his time and his place. Because in this context, in the context of this citizenship guide, he's being brought forward as an authority of our time and our place. His words, in other words, are meant to be reflected on today as a guide to our identity. This from a British lord who really didn't want to be in Canada in the first place. He would much rather have been ambassador to the United States. And he carries forward all of these ideas about the innate racial superiority of the British. I think this is dangerous territory for the government to be dabbling in. And I'm really, especially given John Buchan's views on Jews. Many of his novels have villainous Jewish characters, complete with descriptions of their facial features and so on. You know, the stock repertoire of 1930s anti-Semitism.
Well, isn't that kind of contradictory when you think of our government's all-out support for Israel?
Well, I would have thought that it would have caused a few eyebrows to go up around the tables in Ottawa when they brought forward John Buchan as our leading authority on multiculturalism. I mean, Mordecai Richler wrote a wonderfully sarcastic review of John Buchan, when he really went after John Buchan's depictions of Jews in his letters and his novels, and said, you know, this is just so typical of this kind of genteel, refined British aristocratic disdain for Jewish people. Never perhaps quite rising to the level of a fascistic attempt to destroy them. And yet it's sort of like an Agatha Christie novel, where if you encounter one villain who's Jewish, you sort of say, that might be just bad luck or just a chance encounter. But when villain after villain is Jewish, you sort of say, I think there's a pattern here. And in John Buchan, the use of the language, the way he resorts to villainous characters is very interesting. Now, I shouldn't say that all of John Buchan's villains are Jewish. Some of the threats to the British Empire also come from Muslims and from the Irish, and of course from black Africans. John Buchan writes plainly they are people who are committed to dark savagery, and it is the white man's burden, according to John Buchan, to bear the responsibility for history, because these are dark men, and I'm quoting directly, dark men who live only for the day and their own bellies.
What's with this love affair Harper has with the British monarchy?
It's really, really interesting and strange. I see it as kind of a desperation move in a way. Harper, you know, does not represent the cultural views of most Canadians. He certainly isn't on the same page in Quebec, but also in English Canada, he's not really chimed in to most of the core values that we would associate with Canada. So what do you do in this situation? How can you appeal to some sort of lowest common denominator of what people can identify with? Well, I think he's turned to a kind of sentimentalized, nostalgic view of the empire to try and work this magic. I don't know if it can work, and I don't think it's really going to work in Quebec. So there is something a little bit strange about it, but that's clearly what he's trying to do, is he's trying to find symbols and myths that can replace the ones that he's inherited from the liberal days of the 1960s to 1980s. What they're really trying to do is undermine any concept of Canada that was associated with Pearson and Trudeau and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and social democracy. This is a root and branch cultural war against social equality, against the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and against all of the ideals, the real ideals of multiculturalism that Canadians thought they were identifying with after the Second World War. They're trying to turn the clock back to the 1920s.
It's a long way.
Yeah, it is. It's been amazing to see how complacently and quietly Canadians thus far have responded to this cultural campaign of rebranding Canada. The other big thing to turn to images of war, and this is where the War of 1812 comes in. I don't really think they're all that interested in promoting the War of 1812 in and of itself. After all, this is a war with the United States, and they're great buddies with the United States.
But they're putting $28 million into it.
Right. It's a little odd to be celebrating a war in which we're, you know, at war with their primary allies in the world. But I think what we're going to find in this is a lot of celebration of war just for itself. It's going to be a celebration of war, and you don't really need to be too worried about the particular war. What they're going to tell you over and over again is war is the foundation of the Canadian character. Canada was founded in war. I heard somebody from Ottawa the other day trying to explain that the War of 1812 was really the foundation stone of Canadian multiculturalism, which I found like, oh, that's a real stretch, right? But they're going to play up the War of 1812 as our foundational moment so that we know that we're all about war all the time. So they're really trying to transform this idea of a peaceable Canada, a caring and sharing Canada, to a warrior nation. How radically they're trying to really change how Canadians think about the country. You know, make us totally comfortable with the idea of being almost at perpetual war with somebody or other. I mean, the mystery here is that Canada has no real enemies. Canada harbors no territorial ambitions on the lands of another country. You know, if you say, well, we must defeat our hereditary and traditional enemies, I'm not sure who you'd pick. So that, you know, we are actually a country at peace. But you would never guess it from the media and from the you know, the tone that is struck by the government, which is really trying to rev us up to a permanent state of war fever. Profoundly dangerous stuff.
Well, I suppose that's what's behind the Thursday mega ceremony in Ottawa with the helicopters and the fighter jets, because we won in Libya.
Well, it's going to take many years to find out what was won and what was lost in Libya. I think it's a little early for us to say that we planted a parliamentary democracy with reverence for human rights and a stable and happy society in Libya. The temptation that the government is yielding to in Afghanistan, in Libya, and probably now soon in Iran, is to make us believe that war is an instrument that will solve almost every problem. The people who, when they're equipped only with a hammer, they think every problem looks like a nail. This government almost has that approach to militarism, where they really do seem to believe that at a time when they're talking about cutting back social programs, economizing on Medicare, et cetera, the one thing that they will want to spend like drunken sailors on is the military. We're into a huge military buildup. In a country that's at peace.
Yeah, when I read about this $200,000 going into cenotaphs to war veterans, I thought, okay. But when I read that there was a law also that stipulates 30 days in prison for anyone defacing them, I thought it was a joke. I mean, to what extent is basic ignorance behind? I mean, all you said about John Buchan made me think they're not too bright.
Well, there is a brightness to this, because they're really doing classic wedge politics. Every time that somebody criticizes this government, for example, on the Alberta tar sands, which you wouldn't think had any connection to with loyalty to Canada, you can be critical of what they're doing in northern Alberta and be a perfectly loyal Canadian, I would have thought. No, not in the eyes of this government. In the eyes of this government, the people who raise that kind of question are now seen as attacking Canada itself. This is reminiscent of the Taliban Jack campaign that the extreme right waged against Jack Layton. And, you know, Jack Layton's crime against the country, so-called, was to urge the importance of negotiating with moderate elements in the Taliban, precisely what NATO is now doing, right? Back then, it was fair game to call him Taliban Jack, to imply that he was conspiring in the deaths of Canadians, etc., etc., etc. And they're using the same kind of shock and awe tactic and rhetoric against anyone who dares to criticize whatever they're doing. Very, very polarizing politics, drawing upon deaths of soldiers and all the emotions. This is very, very potent stuff. I wouldn't minimize the damage it can do.
Given the kind of funding that this government, I wonder who's getting the research money for this kind of stuff.
The interesting thing is just how much money is being pushed into these defense think tanks. Many of the recipients of this largesse appear in our newspaper columns, on our radio and television broadcasts, as disinterested, impartial commentators on military affairs.
Conflict of interest.
Many of these people don't tell you is that they're receiving quite a bit of support, shall we say, from these military think tanks, which are in turn supported by the Department of National Defense. They should be required, in my view, to put a kind of disclaimer on everything they say, saying, you know, so much of this opinion piece was funded by the militarists in Ottawa. And this is not, in fact, an honest and impartial statement of my viewpoint. It's something that has been bought and paid for. But that's not going to happen. So you see endless newspaper columns, endless opinion pieces that are, in effect, almost propaganda for the new militarism. And you and I are paying for it. We are paying to propagandize ourselves.
Oof.
it's quite a startling turn of events. And I really just want to wake people up to it. And really is the responsibility of everyone who was alarmed by this development to dig in and fight it with whatever research you can.
Well, I really thank you for joining us on the program
my
today.
Pleasure. My pleasure. I hope that some of your listeners will take up whatever arms they have researching this really amazing process of rebranding Canada. There was a really good line by Tony Judd that he used in one of his columns in which he was talking about similar campaigns run in the Republican United States. And he said, we've seen many European countries that experimented with these cults of blood and death, but none of them were called democracies. Rings pretty true in our case as well.
Well, it seems to be a hard nut to crack. People cling to this image of Canada as a democracy. It might take a little while for people to figure out that maybe it isn't anymore.
The signs are very ominous.
And I want to repeat the book that's coming out, Warrior Nation, Rebranding Canada in a Fearful Age. You can look for it opening days of 2012. We've been speaking with one of the authors, Ian McKay. The other one is Jamie Swift.
Right.